my family's military history goes all the way back to the Civil War in the United States. My great-grandfather was about third in command in the U.S. Navy back in, around 1880, 1901, somewhere around there. I don't know the exact years. My father, he was in the military. My stepfather was in the military. My brothers were in the military. My whole family pretty much was in the military.
Can you explain to me what your job is as far as you're concerned, or what it was?
I was a courier.
Uh-huh. And you're working for U.S. Naval Intelligence?
Yes. I came into Canada from Moscow.
Your intentions here were what?
To pass a pouch off to an individual here in Canada. That individual would have brought that portion of the pouch to the people he worked for, and then I would have returned to the state with another portion of a different pouch.
And what did you do when you weren't able to hand this pouch off, or the contents of the pouch off?
I opened it.
Okay. Were you surprised by the contents?
I was a little bit shocked. I would have thought that somebody would have explained to me exactly what it was that was in there. Well, I was supposed to meet around the 5th, 4th and the 5th, and I went to meet with this person. There should have been two people there, not one. When I got there was only one person there. And the individual told me that Mark Bastion, who is now dead, and he was one of the individuals that I should have met, that he wasn't coming in until around Christmas time. So I was just to give the pouch to him. So what I did is I gave him a blank bag. It was just the pouch was the same pouch, but it had different documents. It had blank papers in it. I wasn't going to hand it off to somebody who had no right to have it. I know that after I passed off the dummy bag, I made a phone call to somebody and let them know what I did, and they exploded. And I set the meeting up again for the 6th, and I made it in a more public place where there were a numerous amount of people there. And that's when the fugitive squad from Toronto arrested me. I wrote a letter to Mark Bastion around June of 2000 when I was in jail, and I sent it to CSIS headquarters, to the director, and asked them to have it couriered back to him. They got the letter, and someone came to see me, actually two people, two members of the RCMP NSIS. They came and saw me in August, and they told me that he was positively dead, but they had told my lawyers prior to that he was most definitely dead. They never said he was murdered. They said that, I guess, he died of natural causes. So I found out in August of 2000. I told them right to their face, if he's dead, that's not what happened, that he was murdered.
How long have you been employed doing this kind of work?
That specific kind of work since 1986.
Right.
Enlisted in July of 1984. The RCMP members of the Canadian Embassy in Washington asked the United States government for a copy of my military file. They just wanted to have it. The United States government told them, no, you can't have it. So I contacted the Congressional Liaison's office, which is in Tennessee, and I asked for a copy of it, and they have to give it to me. So out of 1,200 and some odd pages, they sent me 56 pages, and all of them were altered. They say that on their documents it shows that I entered in November of 85, but I have letters that I wrote home to my mother from boot camp in July of 1984. We have the actual original envelopes. I first asked to speak to the Canadian military, or CSIS, on December 6th of 2000. I even put it down in writing. It's part of the immigration file. I asked to speak to them. They ignored me. In August, when the RCMP NSIS came, I told them to their face specifically about the World Trade Center. And my comment to them was, when someone bombs or someone nails the World Trade Center, I told them, I said, don't come back to me whining, asking me for information, saying I should have given you more when you're ignoring me now. Then what I did when they left is I was writing a memorandum to Vernon Clark, who's Chief of Naval Operations in the United States. I took a document that I had wrote, and I put it in an envelope. I sealed it, and the the government opened it up on September 14th, 2 days after, or 3 days after, And it was a specific individual who opened it because it was the same person that knew what was going on and the same one who had taken it from me. He's the one who opened it, and he was gone from work for 3 days. He opened the envelope up on the 14th. He read it, what was inside of it, and it was sealed in August, and he knew it. And they basically, they turned blue. This is, my lawyer asked me, is there any way to prove anything at all that we can show the court right now to prove that you're a member of the military? And I said, well, you can always call the Pentagon and ask. And Kevin Wilson, the Crown, he, you know, had a fit. Oh, that's not proper, blah, blah, blah. Justice McDonald said, you know what? He goes, if he calls the Pentagon and they verify, he goes, I want to hear this. Basically, he, the judge was just, if I want to hear what's going on. So my attorney, Paul Solansky, went and bought a speakerphone, actually, and he plugged it into the courtroom. He called Information in the United States and asked for a number for the Pentagon. The operator that he called is just a regular operator, 1-555-1212. You ask for the number for the Pentagon in the United States. They give you a telephone number which links you to the Department of Defense operator. He got through to the Department of Defense operator. He was transferred through to the Pentagon operator. He asked the Pentagon operator if she could find my office. She said yes. She verified who I was, that I was a lieutenant in the U.S. Navy. She verified what office I was in. She verified the phone number to that office. And she verified that it was active, I was current, at the Pentagon. And this was all in open court, and it's part of the court record.
What are your plans now? I mean, you...
I'm going to bring the documents public. That's the best thing for me to do, is to bring them public, because you can't let something like September 11th happen and then hide the truth of what really happened, who was behind it, and who had knowledge of it, the fact that it was going to happen, and let them get away with it. Let them get away with not doing something about it.
Uh-huh.
They could have stopped it. They could have stopped those planes.
Right.
And anybody who says that they couldn't have is a liar.
J.R. Nyquist is a renowned expert in geopolitics and international relations. He's an author and journalist, and he's looked into Delmar Vreeland's story.
You know, when you first talk to Vreeland, you have a hard time making up your mind whether or not he's making it up or not. And the one thing that I noted that his bearing in his conversation is not that of a military officer. I mean, I attended Quantico, which is Marine Corps Officer Candidate School, is the same place that naval officers who don't go to Annapolis go. And I even asked him about Quantico, and he refused to talk about it, because obviously, having been there myself, I could determine quickly whether he'd had any naval officer training. It was obvious for me in talking to him that he knew almost nothing about international politics, and that his political knowledge was quite flimsy. It was something that you would expect from a high school senior or college sophomore who hadn't done much reading. But yet he talked about some of these technical things in a very convincing way, as if he had seen documents or he'd talked to someone who had. And that got my curiosity up, and I thought that, you know, the spy game employs all kinds of people. And so I looked at it. I gave it a chance. And, of course, what I found out later was that when looking over his legal brief, is that there's something much different here than he at least claims. In his own affidavit presented to the Canadian court, he admits that basically that he went to Moscow to meet with Russian security agents, and that he passed documents in Canada to Russian Secret Service officials, Russian intelligence officers. And now he claims that the documents were fake documents that he passed them, but he admits to passing them documents. And he admits in the affidavit that among the first people he attempted to contact, that he did contact upon being arrested, was the Russian embassy in Canada. Now, this is something that an American agent doesn't do, but it's something that a panicked Russian agent might do. Who killed Mark Bastion and why? Well, you have an American in Canada being arrested after traveling to Moscow, who admits to passing documents to a Russian security official 6 days after, who immediately calls the Russian embassy, and then 6 days later, Bastion is dead. Now, you can draw certain conclusions from that. You can't draw firm conclusions. You can speculate about it. But it's very intriguing, and it raises questions, which, of course, we can't answer because we don't have security clearances and we don't have all the information. But it paints a very different picture of Vreeland, if you just look at the bare facts, than what he then attempts to create in the aftermath. I was contacted by Vreeland's brother, Terry, who said, you know, my brother's been a petty crook his whole life, is what Terry's claim is. And Terry passed me his Vreeland's, basically his criminal rap sheet, which is quite extensive. He's wanted in like 6 states here in the U.S. And, of course, if you can get Terry on the line and have him tell you, of course, you might hear more than you want to hear about it. Those are the sort of things. Now, of course, Vreeland explains this is part of his cover. And I asked Terry, I said, is it possible your brother was, this was cover, that your brother was in naval intelligence in some kind of a thing? And he didn't think so, because he says he was too busy getting in trouble with the law to do anything else than what he was doing. And, you know, it's interesting, in his legal brief, Vreeland makes a big deal about the fact that he was in the United States Navy, which he was, and that he couldn't have been in the United States Navy if he'd had a prior criminal record, which is what his criminal record in the U.S. says, and therefore the criminal record is some kind of U.S. government fabrication. But what his brother Terry told me was that he used Terry's Social Security number to join the Navy. Apparently that's the case, if you look at his military file.
Mike Rupert, a former LAPD narcotics officer, is publisher and editor of From the Wilderness, a newsletter he founded in 1998.
Well, a closer examination of what appears to be the evidence leads to a whole different set of facts that really give credibility to his story, not the least of which is the fact that the U.S. Navy has submitted documents indicating that he has in excess of a 1,200-page service record, which is impossible for someone who was supposedly in the service for only 4 months and discharged for unsatisfactory performance. The court record shows that a call was placed from open court to the Pentagon in January of 2002, wherein a Pentagon operator confirmed his assignment and the rank of lieutenant at the Pentagon. There's a number of things which, if you look deeply, especially about the history of his attempts to warn both Canadian and U.S. government officials about September the 11th, that really gives solid meat to his assertions that he knew details of the attacks and was trying to tell people about them. As someone who has investigated covert operations for 25 years, and who has dealt with a number of cases that are legendary and similar to Vreeland's, Edwin Wilson, Al Martin, Chip Tatum, Bill Tyree, and many others, there is a very strong and very consistent pattern in his life experience and his record with records of people who we know were intelligence operatives. There's a lot of press stories showing that he has a detailed criminal background, but on closer examination, one finds very few convictions to back up any of those stories. I have heard Mike say on a couple of occasions, somebody please show me a victim somewhere. And to my knowledge, this is what his lawyers are trying to do, which is to get people to come forward and say, yeah, this is, you know, Mike Vreeland ripped me off. And to my knowledge, there has been no such victim identified. It doesn't seem necessary to me to go out and victimize someone, because when you create a victim, you create a whole new set of problems about a victim wanting restitution and victims asking questions. So, you know, there may be some victims out there. I have never said that Mike Vreeland was a saint. You know, he has done bad things. That's not I'm not disputing that, but that's not relevant to my interest as a journalist, which is, it matters not to anyone in the U.S. or Canada whether Mike Vreeland has committed a crime. What matters to the whole world is whether he wrote an accurate warning and knew about the attacks of September the 11th before they occurred and tried to warn. That's the issue.
Judy Horrigan is a Michigan furniture store salesperson who hired a private investigator to track down Delmar Vreeland.
think it was in 2 years ago, Christmas time, maybe 3 or 4 days before Christmas. And it was around 8 o'clock at night, which should have been a dead giveaway. We closed at 9, and two fellows came in, went to our receptionist, and pointed to me and said they would wait. I was busy. I didn't get done until 10 minutes to 9. I walked up and apologized, and this voice said to me, I'm moving tomorrow. I need everything. I want you to do it, but only if you remember who I am. But the minute he opened his mouth, I knew who he was, simply because of what had happened before. You don't forget. And because of what he did to his stepdad, I was being cautious.
So this person was Delmar Freeland?
Definitely. I never touch any of the money, so when I took him to the office, he said to everyone, and you have to understand that he is probably one of the smoothest people and one of the most intelligent people I've ever run across. He said to the office, do you take American Express? We said yes. He said, well, when American Express mailed me out my new card, somebody got it from the mail and charged $25,000 on it. He said it was horrendous for him to get that off of there, which I, you know, could certainly understand. And he said he worked out a deal with American Express where that if he punched in his PIN number, they would approve it. If he didn't, they would think it was the fraud person and they would turn it down. And he said because of what happened to him, we wanted all of us to turn our backs so he could punch in his PIN number and we wouldn't see it. But because I was being cautious, I turned around and watched. He punched in three numbers, and the Zen machine printed out all the approvals. It made me even more leery of what was going on because he had just changed his name. Instead of being, his real name is Delmar Edward Vreeland. He made his name be Edward Delmar. And when I saw that, I said to him, what's this? And he said that somebody was after him in Michigan and he didn't want to get killed or something to that effect. And that's why he legally changed his name. And he had a passport to go along with it. And I was horrified when what I heard. I mean, I laughed because I couldn't believe that people could be this stupid. He has nothing to do with the U.S. government. I also work with a fellow that grew up with him and used to hang around with him and used to hang around at his house a lot. The way that Delmar first started making money was, or maybe he was making money long before that, he had an internet business where he would sell brand new computers at a discount price, but he never delivered one computer. All those people lost their money. I hired a private detective and paid for it out of my own pocket, and that's when I became really aware of Delmar Vreeland and what he does. And this is how he earns his living. So the police stations would turn around and bond him out, thinking that because he was using a different name and that person didn't have a record, they'd bond him out and then he'd be long gone. And this has gone throughout the whole United States.
Lieutenant Keith Fry works for the Troy Police Department in Michigan and was the investigating officer in one of Delmar Vreeland's fraud charges.
I became familiar with Delmar Vreeland in December of 1999 through an investigation of some fraudulent credit card transactions at an establishment in our city. I was the officer in charge of the investigation. I was working in the Detective Bureau at the time, so the original incident report was taken by other officers and forwarded through our Detective Bureau. Through my investigation, it became apparent to me that Mr. Vreeland was responsible for four separate fraudulent credit card transactions at this establishment. We are seeking extradition on our charges, but I think he may be wanted elsewhere throughout the United States as well. Well, I know that I had contacted representatives in the federal sector to try and seek him because I had information through my investigation that he had possibly fled the country. I knew he fled the state, and then as things materialized, I became aware that he may have fled the country. The name at the time that these transactions took place that he was using on the card was Edward Delmar. Basically, it was a fraudulent account that was established, and like I said, under the alias, this different name that he used, and it tapped into someone else's credit, and then he made a number of purchases on that account, that knowing that it's a fraudulent account, they're all fraudulent purchases. And every time he uses that account to make those purchases, it's an additional charge. The store didn't get a verification from American Express before the charges went through, and the account, in fact, had been flagged by American Express prior to the transactions. I don't know enough of the specifics on what type of statements he's made. I'm aware in general terms what he has said, but let me just say this. Based on my investigation, I would be hesitant or reluctant to believe anything that he has to say. And that's just based on things that I've been able to determine through the course of my investigation. Now, I only had this case, but in tracking Mr. Vreeland down and trying to find him, I came across a number of victims, not just in Michigan, across the United States. Well, normally, if there's a doubt in an investigator's mind as to who it is that they're dealing with, normally they would hang on to him until they can verify that. And what surprised me about Mr. Vreeland was, and that's why I surmised that he's probably such a smooth talker, that he was able to convince so many different investigators from so many different agencies that he was somebody other than who he was. And then he would get out on bond, and then I would confirm afterwards through fingerprints, you know, with the agency who they really had. And it just surprised me that he was able to do it successfully so many times. I hate giving the guy any more publicity because I don't think he deserves it. But again, I can understand the interest surrounding this 9/11 thing. I think everything that goes on, he twists and uses to his advantage. And even this deal with the charges being dropped up there, I think that was primarily done because we wanted him back here just to expedite things. And, all of a sudden, as it's tied into this 9/11 thing, all of a sudden there's this cloud of doubt that's tossed in everyone's mind. Was this done for other motives or purposes? And he's very, very good at twisting things to his advantage.
Norman Solomon is a media analyst and writes a weekly column for Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting.
What troubles me about the note is the assertions that have been made about it, that it is a advance warning note predicted or provided details of what was to occur on September 11th. And, I'm a media critic. I write a weekly syndicated column on media and politics, and I've done that for the last 10 years. So whatever the venue or source of assertions, I think it's important for myself and, for that matter, anybody else, to think critically and not just take on faith what is said about a situation or, for that matter, about a document. So in the case of the document of the handwritten words that were written by Mr. Vreeland, apparently, I felt that to look at those words was very important. And when I look at those words, and anybody I know who I've talked with about it who looks at those words and puts any kind of possible, rational, plausible construction or interpretation on those words, the idea that they comprise some kind of, quote, detailed, unquote, advance warning of the events of September 11th, I think is preposterous, And so just as I would challenge the New York Times or the San Francisco Chronicle or any other account that I thought wasn't solidly based on information or plausible analysis, I also am going to challenge an assertion that it's a warning note when it clearly and obviously is not. So that's really what has been, in many ways, my primary concern on this matter. The only dates on the note are the year 2007 and 2009. So I think the dates 2007 and 2009 are pretty far from September 11th, 2001. And the numbers that I see as well on there are a 96-97. It's unclear whether those are dates or not, but even if they are, that's 96 and 97, again, pretty far from 2001. So it's kind of strains credulity, the idea that this note, whether written haste or not, was somehow a detailed warning of what was to happen. And in fact, there's a list of possible targets in Canada, the U.S., and elsewhere, more than half a dozen of them. You don't have to be brilliant or clairvoyant or to have inside information to know that the World Trade Center might be a target of something, since it already was a target. And, another way to look at it is, let's say we had these handwritten words in front of us, and it was in August of 2001. What possibly could we see in this note that would in any way make us believe that we had to take specific preparations that would have in the slightest reduced the chances of the catastrophe that did occur on September 11, 2001 actually happening? I think there's really nothing in there that would have tipped anybody off to anything. And this really troubles me because it's the notion that we will project our own mindset into it from whatever vantage point, and then somehow we're supposed to Rorschach our way into thinking that this is some kind of warning. I mean, you know, the excuse has been given, well, he didn't have much time. Well, how much time does it take to write a word like airplane or write the date 2001 or 2002? I mean, it doesn't take any time at all.
On May 15th, 2002, Delmart Vreeland and his lawyer, Paul Slansky, debated Norman Solomon from Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting on the program What's the Verdict, broadcast on KPFA in Berkeley, California.
If you look at the document, what you have to understand is that this document is just not one piece of paper, like writing out a letter to somebody, okay? He's not mentioning the fact that I spoke with NSIS from Canada, Royal Canadian Mounted Police, the CIA, the Secret Service, the FBI, the military. They were calling me and coming to see me in jail, okay? There's a lot of stuff on here that has nothing to do with 911, but the top portion most definitely does, and other issues inside here do. Right? He has no clue what he's talking about. How can you explain what it is? It's not meant to be a, per se, warning note. What this was, it was a letter that I wrote and I sealed, and this was after the meeting with NSIS, after I told them the specific dates and times and places of things to happen. I told them I was going to write this down, and I was going to seal it in a letter, and they could open it after the fact.
What I think that the basic problem here is that Norman is missing the point that, as Michael was trying to say, it's not a warning note. What the situation was that the American and the Canadian authorities were warned in early August, many people are going to die. Mr. Vreeland wasn't prepared to give them the details initially until some steps were taken to protect his life, because two times prior, his life had been put in jeopardy when he warned people about harm that was going to happen and or testified in court about various things. So we were warning the American and Canadian authorities about this, saying back in early August, many people are going to die. Steps have to be taken to confirm all this. It's going to happen in the next few weeks. And that was in early August. And that's where you get the date. The various other dates referred to in the document don't have anything to do with being a date of predicting. We were telling them, and the RCMP will confirm this, that in the next few weeks, many people are going to die unless steps are taken.
Yeah, this is a very interesting new wrinkle, because on many occasions, both Mr. Vreeland and Michael Rupert have said point blank that this was a detailed warning. As a matter of fact, I have in front of me a quote from Mr. Rupert in writing. He said that Vreeland, quote, was able to write a detailed warning of the attacks before they occurred, unquote. So in a way, it's time to stop the presses, because here tonight we have the attorney for Mr. Vreeland saying that, quote, it was not a warning note. When Michael Rupert says that this is a warning note with detailed information about what was to occur and it's not, I think that does go to questions of credibility.
I didn't write this document so a person like Norman Solomon could figure it out. That was the whole intent. So if somebody got their hands on it, they wouldn't understand exactly what I was writing. But in the 37-page document I wrote to Admiral Vernon Clark, I was very specifically clear in the statements that I made to the CIA and the FBI and the RCMP and NSIS. I was very specific and very clear. A month before September 11th, okay, I write down the names of the targets that are hit, okay? What did I do, just pop that out of the blue?
Mm-hmm.
The point isn't what the exact details of the note are. The point is that it indicates targets such as the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, White House, and targets that were later confirmed to be targets, such as the Sears Tower in Chicago and the Parliament Building in Ottawa, where there was an anthrax scare. We don't know whether it was real or not. The point is that he's saying in August this is going to happen in the next few weeks. Now, yes, if you knew that in September 11th there was going to be a terrorist attack, to pick out the World Trade Center might be logical. But who knew that on September 11th there was going to be a terrorist attack? And if that's the point, and now he didn't say in the note September 11th, 2001, but it's clear when you look at the affidavit, you look at the testimony in court, and the corroborating documents, that there is significant corroboration about all of this.
There were five officers, and then there was one RCMP Corporal Kispel who testified. There was also a document written by the superintendent of the facility stating that, yes, I wrote this note with these pens prior to September 11th. Mike Rupert knows what's going on. He was there. He saw it. He has firsthand knowledge. Norman Solomon has nothing but his mouth.